Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Lisa Alaferis, health editor at KQED News and your moderator today. So as voters are considering various propositions on this coming Tuesday's ballot, we'll focus on a particularly controversial one that's been getting a lot of attention in San Francisco, Proposition E, the so-called soda tax. Last summer, the Board of Supervisors put Prop E on the ballot, a 2 cents an ounce tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. San Francisco's tax is estimated to bring in $35 to $54 million a year, with money specifically earmarked for nutrition and physical activity programs, mainly in schools and parks. Berkeley, too, has a sugar-sweetened beverage tax on its ballot, Measure D. It would mandate a penny an ounce tax, and proceeds are estimated at $1 million a year. So why are cities so intent on taxing sugary drinks? The idea of a sugar-sweetened beverage tax is to make those drinks, not just sodas, but other beverages like energy and sports drinks, more expensive. Prop E backers say the goal is to drive down consumption. That's what happened in Mexico after its soda tax took effect earlier this year. A huge drop in consumption, though, could lead to a huge drop in revenue for beverage companies. They argue that the tax could lead to job loss and further create hardships for low-income people. Opponents also argue that a soda tax would hamper freedom of choice. On Election Day, it's likely that whatever voters decide will resound nationally, as no soda tax has yet to pass anywhere in this country. To look at various sides of this issue, I'm now pleased to introduce today's panel. First, Supervisor Scott Wiener. San Francisco Supervisor Scott Wiener. He is a prime mover behind Prop E. He represents District 8, which, among other neighborhoods, includes the Castro, Glen Park, Noe Valley, and parts of the Mission District. He holds a bachelor's degree from Duke University and a law degree from Harvard. Supervisor Wiener, thank you for joining us. Next, Star Child. He is outreach director for the Libertarian Party of San Francisco, the official opponent of Prop E. He calls himself a freedom activist and says he works to educate members of the public about the dangers of unhealthy public policies, such as government engaging in social engineering. He is a journalism graduate of San Francisco State University. Starchild, thank you for being here. We do also wish to mention that we did invite the American Beverage Association to participate in today's discussion, but they declined. Rounding out our panel is Dr. Rob Lustig, pediatric endocrinologist and professor at UC San Francisco Medical School. Dr. Lustig is also a board member of the Institute for Responsible Nutrition. While Dr. Lustig does not take an official position on Prop E, he has expressed support for measures that reduce sugar consumption in society. Dr. Lustig, welcome.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
So please welcome all our panelists. So, Supervisor Wiener, I'd like to start with you. You are co-author of the soda tax measure. What prompted you to put this before the San Francisco voters?
Sure. And first of all, thank you for having me here today, and thank you to everyone for listening and actually caring about this issue, whatever one's position, because it's an important one for the public health of our city. So this measure, even though the Board of Supervisors, we were the entity that placed it on the ballot, this is not something that was somehow formulated in City Hall. This is an issue and an idea that has been discussed in the community for years. And that's why we have a very, very broad coalition of basically the entire healthcare community, parent community, the park advocacy community, nutrition advocates like the food bank behind this, because this coalition has been building for a long time, because we have a product in soda and other sugary beverages that, like cigarettes, are a known product that are making people sick. And so after years of work in the community at wonderful institutions like UCSF, we decided as policymakers to move forward and do our responsibility of looking out for the health of our city. When we're looking at moving towards one in three people having type 2 diabetes and 23% of teenagers having either diabetes or prediabetes, what we used to call adult onset diabetes, And when you see the scientific literature, which is not refutable, it's not debatable, that sugary beverages are a significant factor fueling the explosion of type 2 diabetes, we felt we had a responsibility to act, and so we put this on the ballot to give the voters a choice, as with cigarette taxes, to use tax policy to reduce consumption, make people healthier, and generate tens of millions of dollars for nutrition, health, and physical activity programs for which the funds are earmarked.
So we'll hear a lot more about the details as the hour goes on, but Starchild, tell us, what is the Libertarian Party's primary opposition to the soda tax?
Well, San Francisco, I think everyone here knows, is becoming increasingly unaffordable, and this is probably the number one concern and news topic of discussion today in our city. And this tax is a tax that would raise the cost of living for some of the most low-income people in the city who are already having trouble making ends meet. It's the wrong tax at the wrong time. Two other California cities have already rejected it, voters by roughly two-thirds in the city of Richmond just across the bay, and another city in Southern California rejected a similar tax. The Mexico tax that was mentioned, we don't know necessarily that the reason that soda consumption went down in Mexico was because of the tax in general. Economists have found that food prices are pretty inelastic. That is, consumption doesn't increase or decrease that greatly as a result of additional taxes, that you'd have to raise the tax by a very high amount in order to have a strong effect on consumption. More fundamentally, though, libertarians feel that your body belongs to you, not to the government. It should be your choice what to put into your own body. And people do many different things that are unhealthy or risky in life, everything from drinking sodas, which I would agree is fairly unhealthy as things go, food-wise, but playing football, skiing, you know, skydiving, smoking cigarettes, lots of other things that are legal, lots of other foods, fatty food, potato chips, junk food that you find at the convenience store. No one thinks these things are healthy, but I think it's an adult choice to decide, yes, it's worth it to me and the quality of my life to consume these things. And if government was really concerned about health as opposed to just taking more money out of people's pockets, they could put warning labels on things or labels on food that would allow people to know what's in them in a responsible way that didn't involve taking more money out of people's pockets. And they don't do that because there's no money in that for them, you know. So we feel that this is an irresponsible measure. It was controversial even on the Board of Supervisors. Only six supervisors voted to put this on the ballot. And I think the public's going to reject it.
And Dr. Lustig, we heard Supervisor Wiener say that the science is irrefutable about sugar-sweetened beverages and sugar in general and its harmful effects on health.
In fact, the science is refutable. we now have data on causation for diabetes, heart disease, and fatty liver disease. Added sugar is causative, proximate cause, both scientifically and legally. In addition, let's be very honest about what sugar-sweetened beverages are. We're talking about something that is not food. We're talking about something that you don't need to live. There is nothing in a bottle of soda that's required for living. So, in fact, it doesn't even meet the definition of food. In fact, as used as directed, it will kill you, not immediately, but slowly, just like tobacco. Now, the FDA couldn't regulate tobacco because it didn't have acute toxicity. But it has chronic toxicity, but that's not the FDA's job. In addition, we now know that sugar is weakly addictive, very similar to alcohol, and in fact is metabolized virtually identically to alcohol and causes the same diseases as alcohol. In fact, we now have an epidemic of type 2 diabetes in children, a disease that was never seen before 1980, and we also have an epidemic of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease all throughout this country. In fact, one-third of America now suffers from a disease that didn't even exist before 1980. Bottom line, we're not drinking alcohol, we're drinking sugar. So, from the standpoint of addiction, the markets should control distribution, sales, and consumption. And for virtually all substances, it does. And we let the markets do their work, except for addictive substances. The markets have not solved any substance of abuse to date. That's why we have an elected government, is to intervene when the markets can't. That's the situation that we are dealing with here today.
So, Supervisor Weiner, the UCSF, a colleague of Dr. Lustig's, has also done an analysis, published an analysis 2 years ago, showing even with a nationwide soda tax, penny-an-ounce soda tax, there would be a modest decline. There would be some modest decline in soda consumption, which would lead to modest weight loss, which would lead to modest declines in type 2 diabetes. But the effect is fairly small. It seems like a small thing to do.
That's actually not accurate at all. So Dr. Kirsten Bivens Domingo, who is a professor at UCSF and practitioner at SF General, did a study showing that a 1 penny per ounce, and we're, by the way, proposing 2 pennies per ounce, but that a 1 penny per ounce tax on sodas would result in somewhere about a 10 to 15% drop in consumption. That is actually quite a significant drop. They concluded that that would avoid 250,000 cases a year of new cases of type 2 diabetes. That's a lot of cases of type 2 diabetes. We know that Mexico's soda tax is smaller than 1 penny per ounce, is a smaller tax, and within 3 months of the adoption of the Mexican soda tax, consumption of sugary beverages or sale of sugary beverage dropped by 10%, in just in the first 3 months. And not just a drop in 10%, but there was an increase of almost 10% in purchases of healthier drinks. And so we see exactly what we would want to see, a shift to healthier drinks. And that actually puts the lie to the American Beverage Association's totally specious claim that this is going to hurt business or hurt jobs. When you stop smoking, you're not going to go to an alternative product. If you're drinking less soda or less sports drinks or less energy drinks, you're not going to stop drinking. You're not going to stop buying beverages. You're just going to buy different beverages. And so people are going to switch. Stores will just sell predominantly, they'll still sell sugary beverages, but they'll sell more of other beverages as well. And the Teamsters, for example, who are delivering these drinks, they'll just deliver a different mix of drinks. And so this tax will be effective, just like cigarettes taxes have been effective, and will make people healthier.
Aunt Starchild, you seem like you're wanting to chime in there.
I would question that on several levels. In Maine, in this country, which has more similar economics to California and San Francisco, I think, than Mexico does, they passed a tax on snacks in 1991, trying to combat this sort of thing, obesity and so forth. And it was found that despite the tax being enacted, Maine's obesity rates increased by 7.3 percentage points before the act was repealed in 2001, when they basically decided it wasn't working very well. And numerous studies have found that there haven't been the effects desired by these kinds of taxes. Denmark also had a law designed to discourage people from buying products that were going to be unhealthy for them, and the result was a lot of their consumers went and bought products in neighboring Sweden and Germany, where the products were cheaper. And the same phenomenon will happen in San Francisco if the tax gets passed here. More people will do their shopping in Daly City. And this is going to hurt small local retailers who tend to have very thin profit margins already. And there's going to be administrative and overhead and record-keeping costs for them. And they also may decide to, I know Scott Weiner doesn't think this is going to happen, but the taxes on the distributors, so the retailers can actually allocate the tax any way they want as far as passing the cost along to consumers. They don't have to add the price of the tax only to the kinds of drinks that are being targeted at the distribution level. They can decide, well, I'm going to keep my tax on sodas relatively low compared to other foods, so that we don't have suddenly a huge price jump in one category. And then there's also numerous exemptions to the tax. Some would say classist exemptions. You know, the Starbucks sweetened fatty beverages favored by upper income people more are not included in this. While sodas more favored by lower income people are taxed. So I would say it's not only regressive but unfair and won't work the way it intended.
So we have several points here. I'll come to you in just one moment, Dr. Lustig. I do want to clarify, because I just wrote about this week. This is one point of difference between Measure D in Berkeley and Proposition E. Is Proposition E does not tax drinks that are made individually, but a Starbucks prepackaged drink. So if you bought a bottled coffee beverage that was delivered to the store, that is subject to the tax. Individually made drinks are not. In Berkeley, though, they would tax all those beverages as well. Dr. Lustig, you seemed like you really wanted to chime in there.
There were two issues that were just brought up that I would like to debunk. The first is that this is about obesity. The studies that our opponent over here, actually I shouldn't say opponent because I'm not on either side, but that Starchild talked about in terms of the inefficacy of taxation previously had to do with obesity. No one said this is about obesity. In fact, it's not about obesity. If it's about obesity, in fact, that's why they would win, because it's not about obesity. It's about diabetes. It's about hypertension. It's about lipid problems. It's about cardiovascular disease. If you look at the role of sugar in obesity, it accounts for about 10% of the total. It is a cause, not the cause of obesity. But obesity is not the problem, because obesity doesn't cost any money. The thing that costs money are the diseases that travel with obesity, metabolic syndrome. Those diseases, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, that's where 75% of the health care costs in this country go, and 75% of those would be preventable if we could actually solve this metabolic dysfunction that sugar uniquely causes. Now, if you look at what the food industry generates each year, it's $1 trillion a year in this country. But healthcare costs are $2.7 trillion a year, of which 75% are these diseases, and of which 75% are recoupable. In other words, that's $1.4 trillion a year going down a rat hole, unrecoupable for nothing. And we can't sustain this. So if you instead talk about diabetes, if you instead talk about fatty liver disease, if you instead talk about heart disease, we have very clear data on the role of sugared beverages and specifically sugar in, I should say specifically, and sugar in general in terms of the pathogenesis and also the treatment. We have data now that show that reducing consumption of sugar actually mitigates this and turns it around. The question is, should you be in charge of your own body? And the answer is yes, if you know what you're doing. But you don't know what you're doing. In fact, personal responsibility, personal choice, has four caveats, and they are not met in this argument. The first caveat is knowledge. You have to have knowledge. Well, there are 56 different names for sugar, and you don't know them. In addition, you don't know how much is too much, because the percent daily value is not listed on the label. So you are specifically kept from the knowledge of being able to do the right thing for yourself. Second, access. The fact is that the poor don't have access to healthier choices, because that's not what's sold in the bodegas very specifically. And that's a huge problem and a problem of social justice, but one that actually government can take on and should take on and needs to take on. Number three, affordability. You have to be able to afford your choice, and society has to be able to afford your choice. And the fact is, while Starchild just said that the tax was regressive, I'll tell you what's regressive. Diabetes is regressive because it affects poor people way worse in terms of the amount of cost and the amount of reduction in productivity in their lives, to the tune of about 45% greater costs to poor people than to relatively affluent people. So it actually is more regressive to allow them to slip into these chronic metabolic diseases. And finally, the fourth caveat is your choice can't hurt anyone else. Well, if your employer has to pay $2,751 extra for metabolic dysfunction, whether you're sick or not, just because of the burden on society, that is not affecting just the person, it's him or herself. That's affecting everyone. That's affecting you. So what you eat matters to me, and what I drink matters to you, because ultimately you're going to pay for my mistake.
Now, Supervisor Weiner, we have a question here.
Can I respond really quickly to that?
Quickly, yes.
Okay.
I want to move on to something else. Okay.
Dr. Lustig, you say that obesity is not the issue, that it's diabetes, but the proponents of Proposition E are directly talking about obesity and saying that is the issue and they want to keep kids from being obese. Are you saying they're wrong?
Actually, there's nothing in any of the information that's been promulgated out of City Hall on Proposition E that even mentions the word obesity. It only mentions diabetes and chronic metabolic disease specifically because it is not about obesity. Let me take this one step further to make it very clear where we're, what we're talking about. In America, we have 240 million adults, 30% obese, 70% normal weight. Now, the standard mantra is that 80% of the 30%, that is 57 million people, are sick. So 80% of the obese population have all of these diseases that I've already listed for you. And it's their fault. And if they would only just diet and exercise, we could solve this problem. This is patently untrue. Yes, it is true that 80% of the 30% are metabolically ill. But that means 20% of the obese population is metabolically healthy. They will live a completely normal life, die at a completely normal age, not cost the taxpayer a dime, they're just fat. Conversely, 40% of the 70% of normal weight people have the exact same metabolic diseases as do the obese. They get type 2 diabetes, they get hypertension, they get dyslipidemia, they get cardiovascular disease, they get cancer, they get dementia also. Now, at a slightly lower prevalence, but there are more of them. There are 67 million thin sick people who are getting sick because of their consumption of sugar relative to the 57 million fat sick people. So this is not about obesity because thin people get it too. So if thin people get it, it can't be about behavior. Rather, it's an exposure, and we have to limit the exposure.
So, Supervisor Weiner, can you talk a little bit about how not just the tax would reduce consumption, but it also generates funds?
Sure. And I just want to say just quickly in response to what Starchild said, because that we have been really focused on diabetes and other metabolic problems, and it's the American Beverage Association. Let's actually stop using the American Beverage Association. It's about Coca-Cola and Pepsi, these mega multinational corporations who could not care less about the health of our community. They don't care about low-income people. They don't care about communities of color. We're going to be left holding the bag once they make our communities sick. These soda companies are focusing everything on obesity because they know that obesity is complex. They don't want to talk about diabetes, but that's what we're talking about because, as Dr. Lustig explained, that's what is really at issue here. And when we're talking about the fact that sugary beverages are almost half of all sugar consumed in the American diet because one 12-ounce can of soda has 10 teaspoons of sugar, more than you're supposed to have in an entire day, that's what the problem is. Now, this is a so-called special tax because the funds are earmarked, and that's why we have to get to a two-thirds vote. All of the funds will go to nutrition, physical activity, and health programs, 40% to the public school system for things like school lunch and after-school programs and phys ed, 25% to our park system to expand rec center hours and have more organized physical activity, 25% to our Department of Public Health for things like nutritious meals for homebound seniors, oral health programs for low-income people, other kinds of food and health access programs, and then 10% will be dedicated into a grant-making program for community-based organizations doing this kind of work, the YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs of the world. And so these funds will be reinvested in the community, and it's very much like the cigarette taxes. Cigarette taxes, I'm sorry, Sarshala, but cigarette taxes have been incredibly effective at reducing smoking, and those taxes were then reinvested in the community through education and health programs, and so it was a virtuous circle.
So go ahead.
Yes, Starchild.
Chomping at the bit here. First of all, it's interesting that the proponents in this campaign have been talking a lot about big soda. I mean, that's a term that I never heard before this year. But big soda pales in comparison to big government. And to think that big government cares about people, you know, any more than the food and beverage industries do, I think is fallacious. Look at the public approval ratings of government, people's trust in government in this country. They're very low, and for good reason. While they're talking here about children and all this sort of thing that sells these kinds of ballot measures, have the supervisors asked the federal government and other levels of government not to subsidize production of corn syrup and price supports for sugar in this country and the billions of dollars that the federal government
I'd actually like to hear a response to that. So
just to be really clear, and I said this from the beginning of the campaign, if the federal government, or Sacramento for that matter, were to step up and do what they need to do to try to reduce consumption of these drinks, we would be happy to close up shop and go home and call it a day. But the fact is, it's not happening and it's not going to happen. The federal government can't get it together to pass a budget. It's going on 6 years right now. I would love to see, whether it's a federal soda tax or ending the subsidies for high fructose corn syrup. And there's a reason why right now, in terms of personal choice in the market, that doesn't exist right now, because when you go into a lot of grocery stores, soda is cheaper than water, it's cheaper than milk, it's cheaper than tea, and it's because of the extreme subsidies on high fructose corn syrup. And let me tell you, if we went into, and I would be fully supportive of ending that subsidy, if we went to Capitol Hill, if someone introduced that in Capitol Hill, guess who would be fighting it harder than anyone? Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Red Bull and Snapple and all the other ones, because they want that cheap high fructose corn syrup. So I would love for the federal government to do it. They're not going to do it. Sacramento, we had a soda tax that was introduced by Senator Monning from San Luis Obispo. It failed. And I agree with Starchild about warning labels. Well, then Senator Monning turned around and introduced a warning label bill to say, okay, you want us soda companies to rely on education? Let's put a label on these drinks saying that this increases your risk of diabetes, heart disease, and other health problems. Well, guess who opposed it like crazy? The soda companies. And they killed that warning label measure. So this is an industry that is bound and determined not just to kill any tax that anyone proposes, but to kill any effort to try to either equalize the playing field or to let people know. There is a proposal now in terms of the reforms in Washington, D.C. around labeling of foods so that they're more useful to people. There's this idea, which is a great one. Don't just say how many grams of sugar are in a product. None of us can really visualize what a gram of sugar is. Put the number of teaspoons of sugar. Let's list it that way. Let's have a can of soda say, this has 10 teaspoons of sugar in it. That is useful information. Well, guess who's fighting it? The soda companies and the other food companies. So these are companies that all they care about is their bottom line. They could not care less about the health of our community and the education of our community. And that is precisely when government has a responsibility to step in and represent the community and protect the public health and increase education and make sure that we are doing what we need to do to take care of our community.
Dr. Lessig, we have a couple comments or a couple questions from our audience. One is, should San Francisco propose a local initiative asking for the FDA to revoke sugar's status as grass, generally regarded as safe? And also, is there any amount of processed sugar that you find safe at all?
Yeah. All right. I'll answer both those questions, but I wanted to retort also to what Starchild had just said. Look, no one wants to have a limitation of choice, and no one wants government in their kitchen. I don't want government in my kitchen either, unless there's a more dangerous force already there. And that's what we have right now. In fact, our food has been changed, has been adulterated under our noses. And if you're worried about personal choice and you're worried about liberty interest, where were you over the last 40 years as the food was being changed? Why weren't you complaining then? Now,
People have a choice
of what to buy because of the 600,000 food items in the American grocery store, 77% of them are now laced with added sugar for the food industry's purposes, not for yours. Because they know when they add it, you buy more. You do not have a choice. And poor people have even less of a choice.
So you walk into a store brainwashed and you don't have the ability to look at the shelves and see what's there and read ingredients and decide for yourself what's healthy?
And also, every real food costs 2.5 times more and is going up at 17 cents per year compared to processed food, which costs 2.5 times less.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by real food? Real food?
Real food, food that doesn't have a label. And it's going up only by 7 cents per year. So it doesn't matter about choice if you can't afford your choice. If you lived on the top of Love Canal and you knew that the water tables under your house were causing cancer in every member of your family and every friend you had, but everybody else knew it, what will you do about it? You can't do anything about it because you can't afford to move and you can't pick up and leave. So the bottom line is affordability creates lack of choice. And
well,
so
government creates lack of choice, and one way they do it is by zoning laws that, for example, prohibit urban agriculture. You know, real food is expensive in part because there's restrictions on growing it. You know, the current government rules tend to favor large businesses. Regulations, all else being equal, fall harder on small businesses because the small businesses don't have armies of lawyers and consultants and government relations people to sort through these rules and do their compliance for them. You know, if you're running a small restaurant or a grocery store, you know, and your main business is preparing food or selling food, and that's your expertise, you know, you have to be a lawyer, double as a lawyer and a tax consultant and an administrator, you know, dealing with government stuff to deal with all of this. And it's an unfair burden on these small businesses. And, you know, maybe Dr. Lustig, you know, he has a much more paternalistic, you know, point of view on this than I do, but maybe you would join me and Scott Weiner in getting the Board of Supervisors to pass a resolution to demand an end to the federal subsidies of the unhealthy products that you're talking about. That would be a much more constructive approach to all this and something libertarians could get behind.
So at this
we
point,
don't want government doing that.
I couldn't agree more.
At this point, what I'd like to do, Dr. Lustig, is could you respond to the questions
Absolutely.
About sugar?
Yes.
And then I'd like to bring it down to that mom-and-pop level and talk about jobs.
I would love to see the revocation of the FDA GRAS determination. Now, GRAS stands for Generally Recognized as Safe. It is a FDA program that was started in 1958. And when it started, there were 180 items that were determined to be generally recognized as safe that you could put in your body with indiscriminate zeal, if you like. Now we have 10,000 items on that list, of which turns out 3,000 of them have never been tested, and 1,000 of which the FDA doesn't even know about. The last time sugar was evaluated was in 1986 by a guy by the name of Glinsman, who ran the evaluation. And at that time, sugar consumption was at 50 grams per day. It is now at 100 grams per day. He didn't have high fructose corn syrup, because the studies stopped in 1980. So virtually everything that was learned about sugar prior to 1986 is irrelevant to where we are today. And we have the data, and we need to re-evaluate this. And I have called for this a repeat of the FDA's GRAS determination to try to rethink sugar off the GRAS list. Now, in terms of is there a threshold? And the answer is yes, there is a threshold. It can change with different people based on their metabolic profile, based on biochemistry, based on genetics. But in general, the median appears to be at 24 grams or 5% of total calories. So there is an amount of added sugar that's safe. The problem is that if you take a 12-ounce soda, we are talking about 9 teaspoons of sugar rather than 6. So you are already 50% over your daily limit just by having one can of soda. That makes this a problem of dose-related toxicity. And that's why, from a science standpoint, we need to reduce our consumption.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are discussing Proposition E on the San Francisco ballot, a sugar-sweetened beverage tax. Our guests are San Francisco Supervisor Scott Weiner, proponent of Proposition E, Star Child, he's Outreach Director for San Francisco's Libertarian Party, which opposes Prop E, and Dr. Robert Lustig, noted anti-sugar physician. I'm Lisa Alifaris of KQED News. You can also find video of the Commonwealth Club programs on the club's YouTube channel. Supervisor Weiner, I want to come back to this, take it sort of from the macro level Star Child was talking about to the micro level of the small retailer in, say, the southern edge of San Francisco. It's not unreasonable to think people would say, well, now there's this tax on these beverages. I'm going to go across the border into Daly City, purchase my beverages there. San Francisco, then, I'm still buying them at a lower cost. The tax has no deterrent effect because it's not in effect there. And in addition, businesses lose out. How do you respond to those statements? In fact, the American Beverage Association did sponsor an analysis that found there could be as many as 1,000 jobs lost in San Francisco.
Yeah, the American Beverage Association actually they sponsor a lot of things. They buy up scientists who publish results that are completely inconsistent with results by independent scientists, and they also purchased an economic impact study that actually left out all sorts of important information, like, for example, saying we're going to see a decline in tax revenue from sales taxes, despite the fact that people are going to switch to other drinks and pay sales tax on that. So, and they put a fake-looking government seal on the front to try to trick people into thinking that maybe this is some sort of government-sponsored document. So they say a lot of things, and their hired experts say a lot of things. As an initial matter, the arguments that it's going to somehow hurt business and jobs, which it won't, you can make the same argument with respect to cigarette taxes and alcohol taxes, and so we should get rid of cigarette taxes and alcohol taxes so that we can sell more cigarettes and sell more alcohol and have more jobs and have more revenue for businesses. And I guess someone could take that position. I actually don't think that would be a really particularly good thing for our community. Our city economists actually did an analysis. It showed de minimis job impacts because, again, we're going to see a switch to just different kinds of drinks. And so it's all about shelf placement, and we'll just see different kinds of drinks that are accentuated on shelves. In terms
de minimis might be lost on some people. So
The prediction was somewhere between 80 and maybe double that. In terms of the total number of jobs that might be lost, and that was they were being conservative, and so it's small, if anything. In terms of the what I'll call the Daly City issue that we hear about a lot, that everyone's just going to start going shopping in Daly City, and that's I don't think there's anything that really supports that. And we actually hear that every time we try to do something progressive and forward-looking in San Francisco, that if we ever dare in San Francisco to say the federal government's not acting, the state government's not acting, we're going to act, the sky is falling, and everyone's just going to flee to Daly City and Burlingame and wherever else. And guess what? It never happens. The idea that people, in order to save 2 pennies per ounce on a soda, are going to get in their car and spend gas to go and drive and have to deal with parking and everything else in a city outside. The people are going to leave the city to go shopping so that they can save 2 pennies per ounce on their soda. Are there some people that might do that? Of course, there are some people, but that it's going to be some sort of epidemic and it's going to cause these small grocery stores to go under, I just don't think that is true. We also actually, let me just finish, Star Child, please. We also... We also you know, keep hearing about this issue of the so-called Starbucks is not covered, rich people drinks are not covered. This is a tax on any drink that's distributed in some sort of container, a can, a bottle, a box. And so many Starbucks drinks, of course, do come in cans or bottles that are sold at Starbucks or Safeway or elsewhere, and those are covered by the tax. What we don't cover are drinks that are made on-site that are brewed, like coffee drinks, because if we applied that to Starbucks, we'd have to apply that to our small local cafes as well. And talk about impacts on small businesses, that small local cafes are going to have to measure how many grams of sugar they're putting in, whether it's 25 calories per 12 fluid ounces, which is the trigger, and then have to keep a log of every single coffee drink with sugar that they sell. That would be a huge burden. It would be impossible to administer. But the fact is that this captures the drinks that are really causing the problems around the health of our community.
I also wanted to follow up just with a technical question from our audience, that this is a tax on distributors. There's a reason that you selected an excise tax as opposed to a sales tax, which I'd like you to talk a little bit about. But also, please explain the benefit of such tax when retailers can raise prices on all products to cover it, therefore hiding the price effect to the consumer.
Yes, and that one is another argument that that Coke and Pepsi have come up with and have been spreading around with the nearly $10 million that they've spent against this campaign so far. So this is a tax on the distribution of sugar-sweetened beverages. And there are two reasons why we went with a tax on distribution as opposed to some sort of sales tax at the cash register. First of all, we know that this industry, whether Berkeley passes it, whether we pass it, they're going to sue. We want to make it as defensible as possible. And having an additional, some sort of unique kind of sales tax, we would have a much weaker legal leg to stand on under California law. There are strict limits around sales taxes. And so having it at the point of distribution really helps address that. But on the merits, what we also want to make sure is we don't want people to see a cheap price on the shelf and then get a surprise sales tax at the cash register. We want this tax to be incorporated into the price that people see when they're reading an ad or when they're looking at the price on the shelf. We want it to have already been incorporated into the price. That's what's going to impact consumption. And so the distributor will pay the tax on the first point of distribution in San Francisco, will pass it along to the retailer, and then pass along to the consumer. The Coke and Pepsi have come up with this argument that, well, the retailer is just going to spread that tax across all products. There's actually no evidence to support that. And I think intuitively we know that that's not how retail pricing works. If there is a problem on the milk market and the price of milk spikes at the distribution, at the wholesale level, you pay more for milk when you go shopping. They don't spread that extra price to eggs and to bread and to other staples. Milk gets more expensive. If there's a wheat problem in the wheat market, bread gets more expensive. If you buy a cantaloupe in the middle of winter, a summer fruit, they don't spread that cost to make apples, a winter fruit, more expensive. Cantaloupes are more expensive. So this is a concocted argument by the Beverage Association to try to scare people into thinking if you take this step to try to reduce consumption of sugary beverages, everything you buy is going to get more expensive, and that's actually, there's nothing to support that.
Starchild, we have a question from the audience for you. There's actually two questions. One is, do you support, say, alcohol or tobacco taxes? And also, what real solutions, well, the question actually is, do you understand the role of government, and what real solutions do you have that would be an acceptable way to regulate a known harmful product?
No, I don't support taxes on alcohol or tobacco or anything else that you do. I think that people should have, and this is kind of a radical concept for a lot of folks, but you know, I think the money that you keep that you earn should be yours to keep or choose how to allocate as you choose. I'll respond first to the second part of that question, which was
do you have any ideas of how to regulate a known harmful product?
How to regulate a known harmful product? I think if you know it's harmful, you know, it's a good idea not to use it. So that's the most effective form of regulation happens at the individual level, because when it comes right down to it, government isn't very good at successfully banning things that are consensual activities among adults. You look at the history of alcohol and drug prohibition in this country, massive failure. Prostitution, you know, my profession has been criminalized forever. It's still around, the world's oldest profession. It's not going anywhere. Example after example. And this is not a progressive tax, as Scott Wiener was saying. It's a regressive tax. And these kinds of taxes are often preludes to further restrictions and bans on products. Alcohol was heavily taxed before the enactment of the 18th Amendment criminalizing sales of alcohol in this country. The punitive sin taxes, you know, which this is an example of, I think, set the stage for that. And it's the same old Puritan morality dressed up in new form under the guise of public health. And public health traditionally used to mean things that where your behavior actually affected the health of other members of the public directly, like with vaccines, for example, people getting vaccinated, or an epidemic like Ebola or something. Those are real public health issues. Drinking soda is not a public health issue. It's an individual health issue. And yes, there may be consequences financially to other members of society when government acts through the healthcare interference to actually incentivize people to not take care of their health by saying insurers can't charge more for pre-existing conditions. You know, insurers have to charge everybody the same rate regardless of whether they have a healthy lifestyle or not. You know, things like Healthy San Francisco here locally have that same sort of incentive built in. Everybody gets the same care, you know, the same taxpayer-subsidized care, whether they take care of their health or not. And what kind of incentive, what kind of effect is that creating? And they don't want to talk about that. And you know, and Scott cites these subsidies, these studies, you know, like by the city economic analyst, while poo-pooing the study paid for by the beverage industry. Well, why should anyone think this study coming out of the same government whose supervisors are sponsoring this measure is going to be any more fair or balanced or objective? It's not. You know, the government is the one that's profiting here. They're standing to make tens of millions of dollars of profit per year from the pockets of San Francisco residents and visitors if this passes. They talk about, you know, how the lottery, you know, was supposed to raise money for the schools. You know, and it's not. I mean, government routinely breaks promises. They say all these good things. Oh, the money's going to go for this and this. We're going to fix the parks. We're going to help the children. We're going to create all these wonderful new programs. And then, you know, 10 years later, you find out they're trying to pass new taxes and programs to do the same things that they said they were going to do with the last go-round of increased taxes.
All right, Dr. Lustig, Starchild made an interesting point that what you choose to drink is your own responsibility. It's not a public health issue. And then I have another question here from the audience, but I'd like you to...
I'll be happy to answer that. So, is alcohol a personal health issue? Yes or no? Is it? If you run me over because you're drunk, is it a personal health issue? It's a public health crisis. In fact, the three Norwegian countries, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, in 1977, recognized that this was affecting both sides of the ledger, the negative side of the ledger in terms of car accidents, medical costs, and cirrhosis of the liver, and the positive side of the ledger in terms of industrial productivity. They were all losing money hand over fist. And what they did was they banded together, the three countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and they nationalized the liquor stores so that each item was the same price no matter where you went, and you couldn't go someplace else and get it cheaper. And what they did was, very smartly, subsidized low-alcohol beer and taxed the hell out of high-alcohol spirits, providing both carrot and stick. That is, a subsidy and a tax, a inducement and a punishment. And what they saw over the course of the next 20 years was reduction in consumption of alcohol, reduction in cirrhosis of the liver, reduction in car accidents and medical costs, and increase in productivity. And those gains are still being felt today, 40 years later. Thus, if it's a public health issue, that is, if your consumption affects me, it becomes a public health issue. give you another example. Let's talk about a different issue. Let's not talk about a substance. Let's talk about HIV. HIV. 1979, patient zero. 1981, the term AIDS gets coined. 1984, Gallo and Montagnier discover the virus. 1986, our Surgeon General, Chick Coop, says, we got a problem here. What year did HIV become a public health crisis? It's the ultimate in personal responsibility and personal health issues. When did it become a public health crisis? And don't tell me it's not. It is. It became a public health crisis on November 12, 1991, at 10:30 Central Standard Time, when Magic Johnson declared that he had HIV, and the whole world went, oh my God, this could happen to me. Because up to that moment, it was about the gays and the hemophiliacs and the addicts. And if you weren't one of them, it wasn't going to happen to you. And all of a sudden, everyone said, oh my God, this could happen to me. So personal health issues become public health crises when other people get affected. Well, guess what? 40% of the normal weight population is affected with the exact same diseases as are the obese due to the same exposure. This is a public health crisis. And we have to deal with it in a public health fashion. This is not a personal responsibility issue. This is not a personal choice issue. This is an environmental issue. We have to fix the environment if we're going to fix the problem. Now, how do you fix the environment? I'm not saying taxation is the right way. I'm not saying restriction of access is the right way. I'm not saying interdiction is the right way. I do not have an opinion on this because the University of California won't let me have an opinion on this. But we have to change consumption. We have no choice, and this is not a personal issue.
So there's an interesting question from the audience. Since the purported goal of this tax is to improve people's health and save lives, why not a tax on red meat next, since heart-related disease is the number one killer in the United States? So that's getting into the how far do we go here kind of question.
The question is it red meat or is it sugar? In fact, the data actually shows that sugar is a bigger problem than red meat is in terms of cardiovascular disease. The question is, what kind of fat is in the meat? Now, I'm not going to tell you that the meat that we sell in the United States is good for you. I'm not going to tell you that. Let's just take a plane right now to Argentina. They actually consume more meat than we do. They have these wonderful cattle roaming the Mendoza Valley, which is a huge expanse, and they have grass-fed beef. And if you go to the butcher shop in Buenos Aires, which I have, the meat is pink, and it's homogeneous all the way through, and it's lean, and it tastes fantastic. It's a little tougher to cut, but it is just wonderful. And they do not have an epidemic of heart disease, even though they eat more red meat than we do. And it's not because of the red meat. It's because of what we do to the red meat, because they get fed corn. Well, guess what? We're all getting fed corn, and we're getting fed corn in our sugared sweetened beverages. That's what's killing us.
So there's a technical question here that I'd just like to address really quickly about the soda tax. How is soda defined, sports drinks versus teas, et cetera, in this law? And I actually just wrote about this yesterday, so I'm just going to tick through it really quickly. And if I'm wrong, please chime in. It's sugar-sweetened beverages, and the measures in both Berkeley and San Francisco are roughly equivalent. If a beverage has greater than 25 calories per 12 ounces, it is subject to the tax. So that would be any beverage that tastes like, that is sugary. That's not just sodas. I should also point out that we in the press are guilty of creating a moniker that's created confusion. Diet sodas are not covered by the tax. Diet sodas have no added sweetener, so they are not subject to the tax. But energy drinks, sports drinks, Arizona green tea, a third of a cup of sugar per 23.5-ounce can, very popular with teens. That is subject to the tax. What's not subject to the tax are any milk products, infant formula, meal replacement drinks, protein drinks. So roughly, if your drink has other nutritional value like milk or meal replacement, it's not subject to the tax. If it doesn't, if it's primarily a sugary drink, it is subject to the tax. And the other part of this question, Supervisor, did I get that right, first of all? Okay, good. So is who controls the money coming in as a result of the tax? And I'm going to wait for him to answer for just one moment, because in Berkeley, again, this is a little bit different in Berkeley, they do not earmark the tax. because it is not an earmarked tax, it needs a simple majority to pass, 50% plus one vote, and that money goes into the general fund. The Measure D creates a board of advisors to advise the city council on how to spend that money, and then it's up to the electorate of Berkeley to believe whether many people believe that will happen just as it's supposed to. The money will get spent on health programs. Other people are skeptical, but it's different in San Francisco, and Supervisor Weiner, can you explain that?
Sure, and we made a decision early on to go the route of a legally earmarked tax, which is why we need a two-thirds vote. And so legally under California law, the money has to be spent only on these nutrition, physical activity, and health programs. It cannot be spent on anything else. It's not the only earmarked funds that we have in San Francisco. We have our controller's office very, very diligently monitors that to make sure that funds are being spent legally. We also created a community oversight committee similar to our bond oversight committee to make both recommendations and to make sure we're spending it properly. We also crafted a very innovative, we think it's the first of its kind, measure that for the first time says that these funds cannot be replacement money. What we don't want to happen is for the funds to be used to pay for things that we're already doing and then that existing money gets swept into something else. That's not what we want. So we put language in there saying that a baseline gets established, and this has to be for new additional programming around nutrition, health, et cetera. Coke and Pepsi are sending around mailers which contain blatant lies saying that it's just going to be replacement money. We prohibited that. And then I just want to touch briefly on this whole notion of the sort of the nanny state argument. And I have a lot of respect for the Libertarian Party. It's a certain point of view in the community about a very extremely limited role of government. We see some of that libertarian impulse reflected in the Tea Party, like government, you know, what is it, drown it in the bathtub? Is that what Grover Norquist likes to say? And, you know, you look at what some maybe called nanny state at the time it was enacted, mandatory seatbelt laws. It's a personal choice, I guess some could argue, whether to put a seatbelt on, but we know what the cost is to society of not wearing a seatbelt, and so the government mandated wearing a seatbelt. We require that people driving a motorcycle wear a helmet. We require that children riding a bike wear a helmet. We require that parents not send children younger than 14 to go to work. You can't work until you're 14 years old, because even though you could say it's personal choice, it's a parental choice, and we see Coke and Pepsi saying that here, let it be parental choice. We know that society does have a role to play in terms of the health and safety of our population. And so we do have a role to play here. I'm glad that the Libertarian Party apparently supports warning labels and other ways of making sure people have full information. But education by itself will never, ever address the problem. You have to have education and other policy interventions together and mutually supporting each other. And this tax will actually be able to pay for increased education. You may have seen on the sides of Muni buses, there was an ad campaign showing how many teaspoons of sugar were in a can of soda. That kind of education, those efforts are really terrific. And having more of that, which will be one aspect of this measure, will be very powerful.
So we're coming to the end of the program here, and I want to give everyone a chance to have a last word. Starchild, I'll start with you because you've been waiting a little while now. Are you going to be? Have you been out campaigning against the measure? Is that part of the Libertarian Party's role? Or,
well, I consider this appearance, for one example of campaigning against the measure, even feeling a little embattled here. But I think everyone listening should really ask yourself, where does it stop? You know, what are you doing in your life that might be perceived as risky or unhealthy by other people? Maybe some activity that's not politically popular. Will this be taxed? Will it be restricted? Will it be banned? Because that's the direction they're pushing, especially when there's money to be made in it for government. The Libertarian Party doesn't necessarily support coercive laws requiring labeling, but we would favor those laws over taxes. Taxes is directly stealing money from people. You know, it comes down to aggression, because if there's a tax and you don't pay the tax, if they find out about it, they'll fine you. If they're somehow not able to fine you, they'll come and arrest you. If you resist arrest, they will shoot you and kill you if they have to. And it usually, of course, doesn't come to that in most cases. We know this. But the violence is always there behind the velvet glove is the steel fist. That's what the law is. When you pass the law, you're really saying that we as society are willing to kill somebody if they don't comply with this. That's what it comes down to. And this kind of social engineering is really what it is. And government is profiting from this stuff. They're not some neutral, unbiased, you know, group of do-gooders who only care about our health and our well-being. You know, one out of three government employees in San Francisco as of 2010, and I'm sure it's more today, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, was paid over $100,000 a year. I know Supervisor Wiener's salary is somewhere around there. I don't know what Dr. Lustig makes at UCSF, not technically part of the government, but government-funded school. But these are well, you can tell us if you want, but
$172,000 a year.
The point is, you know, this is our tax money, and the people that are primarily going to be affected by this Proposition E are not making that kind of money. They're low income, and they're going to have less money to take care of their health, take care of their children, do responsible things in their lives if they're having to pay out more money for their groceries. And you may not agree with their grocery choices. I may not. As I said at the beginning, I don't drink a lot of soda myself. I exercise, and I live a pretty healthy lifestyle. But it is your choice. If the government treats us all like children, you know, you'll end up getting treated like children in ways that you don't want. You'll sacrifice more and more of your freedom and control to government, and the state will take an ever-increasing role in your life. It is a slippery slope, and it is fact. It happens to be true.
And Dr. Lustig, so I know you cannot take a position on the tax, but you must be, seeing as you have been very vocal about the health risk of sugar.
Yep.
The such public measures bring more attention to your the message you're trying to get out.
My job is to stop having to take care of obese, sick kids, and I know what's making them obese and sick, and it's in the vending machine, and it's in the kitchen. And the question is, who do you want in your kitchen? The government, who will take your freedom and your wallet, or the beverage industry, who will take your freedom, your wallet, and your health? And they've already taken all three of them. That's really the only choice you have. This notion that somehow we can actually be free of government, is really just a ruse. What I would argue is that we actually know what it looks like when government doesn't intervene. Let's look at Russia. They have an enormous alcoholism problem, and their government does nothing about it. You drink, you die. And it's done wonders for their economy, and it's done wonders for their social structure, hasn't it? Well, guess what? Sugar is the alcohol of the child. It does every single thing that alcohol does in terms of its metabolic detriments, and in terms of what it does to the reward system and what it does to cognitive decline. So the question is, who do you want in your kitchen?
Supervisor,
having nobody there ain't an option because they're already there.
Supervisor Wiener, last word.
Thank you, and thank you again for having me today. This really is about how do we not just improve the public health of our community, but how do we avoid the trajectory that we're on right now towards 1 in 3 people having type 2 diabetes, 1 in 3 people having type 2 diabetes, 1 in 2 people in communities of color. So this whole nonsense of this being a regressive tax, when we have an industry that is targeting low-income communities, that is targeting communities of color, that is targeting children, that, as Dr. Lustig said, is what is regressive. When we look at who is actually getting these diseases and all of the carnage that it wreaks on these communities. And that is why the social justice advocates and health advocates working in low-income communities, black clergy, they're supporting this measure. Because what are we going to do as a society so that we don't have 1 in 3 people with diabetes, 1 in 2 in communities of color? And it's not to listen to Coke and Pepsi. Coke and Pepsi don't care about the health of our community. They care about their bottom line, and that's why they're going to put $10 million into fighting one ballot measure in one mid-sized city, San Francisco. And so we have an opportunity to step up and take an important step. We're not banning anything. Yeah. We're not banning anything. Like cigarette taxes, it is a common sense public health measure that will make our community healthier. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco discussion of Proposition E, San Francisco's proposed tax on sugar-sweetened beverage. However you feel about this measure, please get out and vote on Tuesday. Our thanks to San Francisco Supervisor Scott Weiner, proponent and co-author of Prop E, Star Child, Outreach Director for San Francisco's Libertarian Party, which opposes Prop E, and Dr. Robert Lustig, noted anti-sugar physician with UCSF. We also thank our audience. I'm Lisa Alaferis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.